Hi, it's Diane. On my mind, colleges and universities face tough decisions about whether to reopen their campuses this fall. In March, higher ed institutions were some of the first to shutter, sending students and staff home and turning to remote learning to finish the semester. Now, they need to decide what form instruction will take in the fall. Will students be able to return to campus safely? And if not, what are the alternatives? I spoke with Jeffrey Salengo. He's former editor of the Chronicle of Higher Education. His forthcoming book is titled, Who Gets In and Why? A Year Inside College Admissions. So, Jeffrey, give us a sense of what colleges and universities are currently saying about classes for this fall.
We're seeing a mix of responses right now. We're seeing institutions like the California State University System with 23 campuses saying they're going online only this fall. We're seeing other institutions like Purdue and a bunch of others say we're definitely going to be on campus this fall. And then we're seeing most institutions say we're still doing scenario planning. We have two or three ideas, and we're probably going to announce closer to June or July. The reason why many institutions are announcing now is because deposits are due for this fall's incoming class. You know, either May 1st or some institutions switch that date to June 1st. That's when students who want to have a spot, who've been accepted in this fall's class, have to have their deposit in, and they want to make sure, colleges want to make sure those deposits come in. And as a result, they are announcing, in many cases, we're going to be open because many parents and students don't necessarily want to go to college online.
This week, you had the large Cal State system say they are going to go remote. Why did they make this decision, and how is it going to affect other colleges and universities as they make their decisions?
So I think Cal State made this decision because it is so large. It's in a state that's been highly impacted by the coronavirus, obviously. And because it's so large, they have so many students, hundreds of thousands of students and 23 campuses and faculty members who really have to prepare their classes. I think they wanted to give everybody as much time as possible to get ready for this fall. I think in terms of other campuses, I think they're definitely going to be influenced by competitors. In other words, if most of your students go to a certain set of other institutions or consider a certain set of other colleges or universities, you are going to be watching carefully what those other colleges and universities are deciding. Because what's going to happen is once one institution makes a decision, and I think everyone's waiting for somebody else to make this decision, you're going to see students then make different choices about where to go. So for example, if you already deposited at a college that said they're going to be online this fall, you might switch that now to a different college. Or if the college changes its mind in August and says, well, we have to go online even though we plan to open, you're going to see students switch their deposits if they can. So what I think is happening is many students have deposited at multiple places. There are institutions out there that accept students all the time, many community colleges, for example, or local, regional, state universities. So in August, if I found out the college, my dream college is now going online, I could decide I'm going to take the year off from there and I'm going to go to the local community college, because if I'm going to do online, I might as well go close to home and do something that's much less expensive.
What does it mean financially for a college or a university to go online? How big a financial impact does that have on the revenues that a college or a university takes in?
For a residential college, it's huge. Think about a college campus as a city, and if no one is on the campus, nothing's happening. So it's not like our cities now that are essentially locked down, whether it's New York or Washington or San Francisco. There are still people living in it. There are still people trading commerce, right? Getting groceries, getting takeout. There's still something happening. But on all these college campuses, there's no one on them right now. And so that is a huge hit for colleges and universities beyond just housing and food, but there's also coffee shops and other things on campus that produce revenue. There's research going on that produces revenue from the federal government. There's athletics going on at Division I that brings in a lot of money, and at Division III at smaller colleges that drive enrollment. Many students who play athletics at Division III decide to go to certain colleges because they could play sports. Well, if they can't play sports in the fall, are they going to go? So everything at a residential campus is about having people on that campus. And if you can't have it, it's a huge hit to the finances of that college.
And of course, the logistics of housing and feeding and holding large classes. How do colleges think they can do that? I mean, can you put 300 students in a lecture hall? Can you manage 500 students in a dining hall? And what about residential situations? Can you put two people in a tiny dorm room and safely distance?
Let me start on that last one, Diane, because I'm hearing most colleges and universities now planning to essentially make every residence hall room a single, which has big impacts on, again, on finances, but also on the number of students you can now house on campus, because you can't double or triple students up. In addition to that, you know college students, you know, when you're 18, 19, you don't like to listen to rules. And so I can't imagine you're going to have a set of social distancing rules that students are actually going to listen to. So that's, you know, problem two. And then the third issue is that colleges, again, especially larger institutions, make money the more students they can stuff into a lecture hall or into a classroom, right? So at a big state university, it's not uncommon, especially the first year of a college, to have hundreds of students in a class. Well, you're not going to be able to do that. So how are you going to design for that? So one thing I'm hearing are more hybrid classes. So you might have, if you have a lecture 3 days a week and you have 300 students in that lecture, maybe you only have 100 in one day and then the other 200 are online. And then on Wednesday, you know, another 100 actually come to class and the other 200 are online. So you're seeing a lot of creative efforts because, again, colleges want to have students in some form or fashion on campus this fall.
So what will the difference be for colleges in urban areas as opposed to rural areas?
I just wrote a piece recently for the Wall Street Journal on this with Richard Florida about, you know, urban colleges were hot commodities. You know, people were flocking to cities, students and faculty members, and they were largely doing that because, you know, cities were attractive places, the culture, the athletics, the restaurants, the jobs and internships. But the problem now is that everything that has made cities so attractive over the years is now the exact same thing that is also making them attractive to this virus. I can't imagine how difficult it's going to be to open an NYU or a Northeastern or a Boston University in two cities, you know, that are being hit very hard by COVID-19. And those campuses are incredibly tight, as you know, right? You know, a lot of density on those campuses. So I think urban institutions, and I think parents and students are going to be a little less reluctant. Parents are going to be less reluctant to send their kids to those institutions. And it's kind of a shame because those institutions were kind of the crown jewel of American higher education over the last 20 years. And I think many of them are going to see some tough times, at least in the near term.
What do you see as the differences in the conversations playing out between private elite schools versus public colleges and universities?
Public colleges and universities in some ways will benefit from this, I believe, because people will want to stay close to home. And because affordability is going to be an issue now where we have, more than 30 million people unemployed in just the last couple of weeks, state universities with their lower tuition are going to be more affordable options. On the other hand, though, state universities are, in some cases, are dependent on their state budgets for appropriations. And we know that in this pandemic, states are getting hit very hard. Their budgets are getting hit very hard, and it's unclear whether Congress is going to help bail them out. So state universities, I think, you know, it's kind of two sides of a coin here, where on one hand, I think they're going to be helped by enrollment, and on the other hand, they're going to be hurt by state appropriations. The elites, I think are obviously going to survive because they've survived world wars and other pandemics and so forth over hundreds of years. What's ironic, though, is that, you know, they're all sitting on these huge endowments, you know, tens of billions of dollars. And in many ways, the payoffs from those endowments have helped their budget. So, you know, at elite schools, a third of their budget might come from the endowment. Well, if they now can spend less from those endowments because they're not making as much money, that's actually going to hit their budget just as hard as many other colleges because they're not going to be able to draw as much money from them. So I think across the board, we're going to see institutions get smaller, lay people off because of the pressure on either the state budgets for the publics or the endowments on the elites.
I was fascinated to read in today's Washington Post that Georgetown University here in Washington, D.C., is going to suspend contributions to employee retirement plans, introduce a voluntary furlough program, and halt some construction as it prepares to enter next academic year with a $50 million shortfall. Now, surely we'd have to call Georgetown one of those elite academic institutions, which would indicate to me nobody is out of the woods here. Not big, not small, not elite, not public. Every single one is going to be hit hard.
Yes, I mean, there was a story a couple of weeks ago out of the University of Michigan, over $100 million hit to its budget just this spring. Because remember, many of these big research universities also have academic hospitals associated with them, and they haven't been getting as much revenue from those academic hospitals. Also, many of them are big into athletics. You know, March Madness tournament canceled this spring. Football might be canceled this fall. That, again, is another big hit to their budget. So nobody is safe. Everybody may have different issues and different revenue streams that are being hit, but this is going to be an issue across the board in American higher education.
So let's talk about how schools around the country are planning to open or not open. Is there any consistency in how they're approaching this?
No, there's no consistency. And, you know, I think a lot of it is around regional or city differences, right? So where are we getting most of our students from, or where are we located? So for example, I was talking to an official at Northeastern University in Boston last week, and one of the things they're worried about is their workforce. A majority of their workforce commutes on mass transit. And they're worried, and we know here in Washington, Diane, you know, Metro is not going to be fully in force until 2021. So how are you going to get your workforce to campus if they are mostly on mass transit? And I think that's an issue in New York as well. And so, you know, in Boston and New York have been hit very hard in terms of COVID-19 cases. So I think a lot of this is going to be have many regional differences in terms of who decides when they open, how they open, how many people come to campus. The other issue that we haven't talked about yet are international students. Many of these campuses, again, especially in urban areas, have been extremely popular with international students. It's unclear to me that many of these international students will be able to even get here this fall. And so what I'm hearing from a number of institutions is how they're going to set up remote sites in other countries where they possibly could get people to and have either local professors or a hybrid between online and face-to-face and not necessarily have these students on campus. That, again, is another revenue stream, by the way. Many of these international students were full-pay students, and they made up a large proportion of students at many of these institutions, at many of these elite institutions, and that's going to be another financial hit.
Did I hear something, or have I imagined this, that some colleges and universities were considering allowing only freshman students on campus so that they might at least have that college experience for the first year?
That's one of the many scenarios that are being played out. So one of the ideas is maybe just have first-year students, for example, because as you said, it's incredibly important around retention and eventually graduation that they start off on the right foot. Another idea was to have seniors because you want them to get to graduation and complete. Another idea is depending on the major. As we know, some majors are incredibly hands-on, clinical, performance, right? It's very hard to be a music major or a drama major online. So there may be differences between majors as a result. So I think you're going to start to see differences in those areas as well.
What about phased reopenings? That is, having some students on campus and some students online. Would that make sense?
So I think what you're going to see is a mix of modalities this fall. So you're going to see some students on campus who feel comfortable coming back to campus or want or need to come back to campus. And then you're going to see other students and faculty members, because the one thing we haven't talked about is that there might be faculty members who might be immunocompromised in terms of COVID-19, and they don't feel safe being on campus with, a lot of people. And so I think you're going to see some courses done online only. You're going to see some courses perhaps done on campus only. And then I think you're going to see a big portion of courses, what I would call hybrid courses. So where some students who are able to get to campus or take them on campus in smaller numbers, take them, but then those courses will also be available online. Some students might show up some days, but not other days.
More of my conversation with Jeffrey Silingo when we come back.
Decius Daily.
Decius Daily.
Decius Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
Decius Daily.
Sign up at decius.com/newsletter.
decius.com/newsletter.
Here's the rest of my conversation with Jeffrey Silingo. His forthcoming book is titled, Who Gets In and Why? A Year Inside College Admissions. We've talked about some of the revenue shortfalls that colleges and universities are seeing, but it's going so far as to bring the closure of some colleges and university. I've just read about McMurray College in Jacksonville, Illinois, 174 years old, a small private liberal arts college. Are they the most endangered, those small private liberal arts colleges?
Yes, I think even before this crisis, we were moving toward a change in demographics in the U.S. The number of high school students has been dropping the last couple of years. It was expected to bottom out around 2025, 2026. Most of that was happening in the Northeast and the Midwest, where we have the highest density of colleges anyway. So this was going to come in about 5 or 6 years anyway. I think this just now accelerates those changes. We are going to likely see a drop off in enrollment as early as this fall. So that, coupled with the natural drop off in high school graduates, is going to mean that these small institutions, particularly in rural areas, particularly in the Northeast and the Midwest, particularly in areas that have been devastated by either COVID or the economic impact of COVID. You put all of those things together, and small colleges in particular, missing a class by, 10 students is a huge deal to these small colleges, right? When you only have 1,000 or 1,500 or 2,500 students, every student counts at those institutions. And so missing a couple of students as early as this fall is going to only accelerate those closures or mergers that were going to happen, I think, in 5 or 6 years.
So what sort of assistance do you see coming to those schools from Washington, from the Congress, from the United States government?
I think we might have seen it all. there was in the CARES Act, there was money for both students and for institutions. I'm not quite sure there will be more. You know, higher education, even before this, was not well loved by politicians and actually had some low polling even by Americans. It wasn't trusted. Republicans thought, you know, students were becoming liberals in college, and Democrats thought college cost too much. So there was not a lot of love for higher education even before this crisis. Where I see kind of saving come might be in terms of Congress giving money to the states, and then states giving money to their, particularly to their public colleges. You know, many of these public colleges are located in all corners of all states. They are usually the largest employer in their state, and that also goes for private colleges as well. But the states have an interest and investment in their public colleges. I think if any money is to come to higher education, I think it's going to come from the states to their local colleges in their public local colleges to make sure that they survive.
But some of these states claim they're on the verge of bankruptcy. Or at least that's what Mitch McConnell told them to do, was declare bankruptcy. So how much are those states going to be able to actually help?
Well, I think part of this is going to come hopefully from the federal government. You know, in the Democratic stimulus bill that's out in the House right now, there is money for the states. So the possibility is money eventually will flow to the states, maybe. But, higher education is going to get hit pretty hard in the states. They've always been what's called a balance wheel in state budgets. In other words, you know, K through 12, corrections, Medicaid and Medicare and other health programs are really required for states to fund. Higher education isn't required. And so money usually would flow out of higher education into those other programs. That said, higher education is critically important in many communities in many states. Again, they might be the largest employer, so it would be like a governor or a state legislator saying it's okay if the local factory closes, and I don't think they're going to want that to happen. So I think they're going to do everything in their power to keep these state universities going as concerns as much as they can.
Let's talk about the distance learning that students have undergone this spring. How well has that worked for students and for faculty?
It depends. I think that at institutions that have had long experience in delivering online education, I think it's been a better experience. I will say up front that I'm a special advisor and professor of practice at Arizona State University, which is well known for doing online education. And I think the experience there and at other places, Purdue, Southern New Hampshire, places that have had long histories of providing online education, I think are doing better. At other places, it's essentially what we're doing today, Diane. We're on Zoom. And I think it's essentially a professor getting on Zoom and trying to teach their class either asynchronously, meaning they record it, or synchronously, where they do it in live time. And I think for most students, it hasn't been a good experience. It was really a Band-Aid approach. And in fact, I don't think we should be calling it online education. It's really remote education, because it's not the best of what we know works for learning in the online environment. What worries me is that if we have to be online in the fall, that they're simply going to just continue to replicate what they did this spring. I think it's okay if we do this for a couple of weeks in the spring, but if this ends up being the fall semester for many students, I think it's going to have a huge impact on their learning outcomes. And by the way, I think students are going to walk away in large numbers. I think they're going to say, this is not what I'm paying for. This is not what I want. I'm not doing well in this environment. I'm just going to take a semester off or a year off.
And maybe that year off is not so bad for the student, but pretty devastating for universities.
Particularly since I think there's going to be calls in the fall, and there are already some pressure even this spring to reduce tuition or give tuition rebates if we were online. And you know, most colleges and universities, residential colleges and universities, gave rebates for housing and for room and board, because students weren't eating or living in the residence halls. But they didn't do it in many cases this spring for classes, because they said, we're still teaching. Now I think what students and parents are going to say, but I was paying tuition for the campus-based learning experience, and I'm not getting that. I'm not getting that online, and I'm not going to pay full tuition. So I think that's going to be another pressure point that, you know, and another reason why colleges want to be in person this fall.
I want to ask you about admissions. You wrote a piece about how this may actually result in some much needed admission changes. Talk about how and why.
The admissions process has been a race to college way too early in high school. Students are starting in sophomore year to study for the SAT. They start taking the SAT multiple times in their junior year. They're overloading on their classes their junior year to apply for college early in their senior year. They're trying to come up with every activity possible in order to burnish their applications and resumes. We've taken away high school from students, particularly the junior year. And students in high school are still growing. The teenage brain is developing by the moment in high school. And so in some ways, I think this spring, the fact that all activities essentially have been canceled, SAT and ACTs have been canceled, students haven't been able to go visit colleges, I think in some ways it's given them a pause to think about what they really want next, but most of all, to enjoy high school, to think about what they want out of high school and to think about what they're doing in high school rather than always thinking about what's next, about that next hoop to jump through. And so what I hope comes out of this, you know, one of the things that's happening already is that a number of colleges are moving to test optional, meaning that they're not requiring the SAT or ACT because they can't, because so many of those tests have been canceled this spring. I actually think that we've been putting too much of a focus on testing recently in admissions anyway. And so that might reduce the pressure on students to constantly prepare and take that test. I think the same thing might be true about, you know, going to visit every college campus in the spring of your junior year and the summer before your senior year and really reflecting with you and your family about what you want next. So I'm hopeful that because we put a pause on junior year for the class of 2021 this year, that maybe that might become more permanent. And we might say, you know what, it's okay to really start your college search closer to your senior year rather than so early in high school.
So if colleges and universities don't rely so much on the SATs, what will they rely on?
So, Diane, I spent the last year inside the college admissions process for a book that I have coming out in September called Who Gets In and Why, A Year Inside College Admissions. I was inside the process at Davidson College in North Carolina, at Emory University in Atlanta, and at the University of Washington in Seattle. And one of the things that I think most parents and students, they don't realize how little in some ways, even at colleges that require the SAT and ACT, it is not the determining factor of whether you get in. What's most important to college admissions officers, and we know this not only from what I saw in those three offices in the course of reporting this book, but also in surveys of admissions officers, is high school curriculum and grades matter the most. So what did you take in high school? Did you take the hardest courses available to you? And how did you do in those courses? And you know what? We still have that. Yes, spring semester was kind of canceled for a lot of students, but we know what they were going to take that semester, or we know what they took. Yes, they may not have grades from one semester, but they'll still have grades from the rest of high school. That is what matters most, and it's what studies have shown predicts success in college. What you do over 4 years of high school matters a lot more than what you do on a four-hour test.
What does all of this mean for the educational opportunities for those students who might be considered the most vulnerable?
It's who I worry about the most, Diane. I mean, if you think about it, this spring as schools let out and you went to online learning, many students still don't have computers. They don't have good internet access. They live in homes that are not really conducive to learning. They don't have good meals and quality housing. You know, college provided that, or high school provided their meals to them. And we're already seeing the impact of that. So there's a thing called the FAFSA, the Federal Application for Student Aid, that students file every year. And that's really what qualifies them for federal aid or state aid or even institutional aid. And we saw an announcement last week that the number of the lowest income students filing that form to come back to college has dropped significantly by 250,000 students in just the course of the last couple of months. And by the way, the drop-off has been even larger in the last couple of weeks. And what that says to me is that the lowest income students are planning not to come back to school. And that worries me. And why are they not coming back to school? Because they can't do online education. In some cases, they were helping to provide for their families. Maybe they were working part-time and those jobs have now disappeared. Maybe their parents or caregivers have lost their jobs. We were already doing a pretty poor job in this country of educating the lowest income students. In fact, the number one determinant of whether you went to college and graduated from college was how much your parents made. And so the fact that we weren't doing a good job beforehand really worries me that we're really going to do a bad job in the middle of this pandemic.
What does this mean for the society as a whole, Jeffrey? Looking ahead, if you have fewer and fewer people offered or allowed the opportunity to enjoy a university education, what is that going to mean for society at large?
It's going to definitely change social mobility because higher education is the biggest motivator of social mobility. It's the thing that moves people from the lowest income brackets to the highest income brackets. I think that it's also going to increase disparities and income inequality in our country. But there is a bright spot I see out of this, Diane. And here's the bright spot. Colleges and universities are going to have to respond to this in a different way. Many colleges and universities were after only 18-year-olds. They were after full-time students. They were after middle class and upper income students. To survive, they're going to have to look for new students. And those students could come from the lowest income families, but they also could come from adults who need to reskill or upskill. They will have to create new types of programs and new degrees, maybe shorter degree programs, maybe degree programs that get people into the new jobs that are going to come out of this pandemic. My hope is that in their need to survive, colleges and universities are going to look out at the landscape and they're going to say, this is the new world we're living in now. And as a result, we're going to need to look for new types of students and deliver them new types of degree programs in order to get them into the job. So that is where I'm hopeful, if I'm hopeful for anything coming out of this pandemic.
And generally speaking, what does all of this mean for the future viability of colleges and universities? This COVID virus has really put the focus on so many different things, but surely one of those factors would be the future of these colleges and universities.
We've always had colleges and universities, you know, since before the founding of this country. Some of these institutions have survived hundreds of years. So I'm confident that higher education is always going to be a sector of our economy. Residential education for 18-year-olds is always going to be a facet of higher education. It's how we know students learn the best. It's also a maturing process for 18-year-olds. So I think we may have a smaller higher education system. So some colleges are going to go out of business. Some colleges are going to change because of this, as I mentioned earlier. Other colleges, especially the elites and the ones with a lot of money, will easily survive this in my mind. It's necessary for this economy. There's more people around the world, even after this, that are going to need a higher education in order to not only deal with the economic impact of this, of the coronavirus, but also larger changes to the workforce that were coming anyway. So I think in many ways, we may just have a different higher education system, but I'm confident that we're going to continue to have especially in the U.S., one of the strongest higher education systems in the world.
Before we close, is there anything else you'd like to say?
There's so much we don't know, Diane, here sitting in the summer of 2020. You know, think about it. A couple of months ago, colleges were operating as usual. They had no idea that a global pandemic was going to hit. You know, at first they said, oh, we're going to close for a couple of weeks. Then soon it turned into the entire semester. And then soon we saw commencements canceled. Now we're talking about the fall of 2020. Nobody's crystal ball is very clear right now. And I think that for all of us, whether we're students and parents thinking about college, whether we're college leaders, we should just take a break. We should think about how do we keep our campuses and our people safe, and also think about the near future. Yes, we have to look toward the far future, but we really should be thinking, how do we deal with the next couple of weeks? Because things can change very quickly in only a couple of weeks, and we shouldn't try to get too ahead of ourselves and try to predict we're definitely going to be on campus in the fall or football's definitely going to be played. There's no definites in the world right now. We need to deal with this ambiguity. We need to navigate it. And I think that's going to be okay. I think in some ways we're going to become more resilient and stronger as both people and institutions if we navigate this ambiguity right now.
Jeffrey, thank you.
It was great to be with you.
That was Jeffrey Salengo. His new book is titled Who Gets In and Why? A Year Inside College Admissions. And that's all for today. Thanks to those of you who've reached out to let me know what you'd like me to cover during this very difficult time. Please continue to let us know what's on your mind. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Bent Landsberg of Wonderly. Our engineer is Mike Kidd. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Thank you all for listening. I hope you stay safe, stay well. I'm Diane Rehm.